Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Attention Deficit Hyperactivity Disorder, or ADHD, remains a controversial and misunderstood medical condition. While 10 to 15 years ago, every media entity was doing stories on issues surrounding this condition, today little is heard about the issues surrounding ADHD, despite continuing escalating rates of diagnosis and medication treatment. My guest today notes the simultaneous overdiagnosis and underdiagnosis of ADHD, disparities in diagnosis around the country and why, the huge disparity in treatment with medicine for those that are diagnosed, ranges from 30% in California to over 80% in the South and Northeast, and also the huge increase in diagnosis for adults. Surveys say that up to a quarter of college students are using the treatment stimulants for academic performance. Well, my guest addresses these issues and more. Stephen Henshaw is a professor of psychology at the University of California, Berkeley, and editor of Psychological Bulletin. He and health economist Richard Scheffler are the co-authors of The ADHD Explosion, Myths, Medication, Money, and Today's Push for Performance. It's published by Oxford University Press. In the book, they describe the origins of ADHD, the science behind its causes, as well as medication and behavioral treatment, and the variations in diagnosis and treatment across the United States. Stephen Henshaw is my guest today on Studio Tulsa. Stephen Henshaw, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Delighted to be here.
For a good 10 years or so, I'm thinking like the 1990s, early 2000s, you really couldn't pick up a publication or watch any sort of news magazine without seeing something about ADD or ADHD. But it seems like in recent years, there's been far less publicity about it, even though the rate of diagnosis and treatment seems to be still circling upwards. Why are we not hearing as much about this anymore?
I think the news cycles tend to ebb and flow, but actually over the last few years, as what I'll talk about in a moment, the National Survey of Children's Health, a nationally representative survey of 100,000 random dialed families across the country, had its first iteration in 2003, then again in 2007, and most recently 2011-12, with very high rates of diagnosis and escalating rates reported, I think we're getting a lot more of ADHD back in the news. And it's a controversial diagnosis because in many ways people say, well, look, this is school children. This is kids who are fidgeting and squirming, and we've got too high expectations in schools, and this really can't be a disorder. It's just we're labeling boyhood, et cetera, et cetera. Well, as we talk about in the ADHD explosion, this is a real condition with very severe consequences, requires thorough assessment. But there's some interesting trends in society today that have been pushing this rate of diagnosis up, and we think more than it really should be going up. In other words, there's overdiagnosis, but in some cases, too, because we're not upholding pediatricians and other clinicians to the standards we should, we're sometimes underdiagnosing it as well.
Really? So there is underdiagnosis and overdiagnosis at the same time?
Well, there is. And so here's the bottom line. To carefully diagnose ADHD, you've got to do several things. You've got to get a really good history from the family. Were these behaviors the result of early trauma or abuse? Or one of the cardinal symptoms of depression is poor concentration? Or maybe the kid needs a neurological exam, and this is a case of a seizure disorder with a lot of inattention. The bottom line is it's going to take getting information from schools and parents, very careful ratings so you can compare the child's behavior to other kids, his or her age. It's going to require getting that thorough history. However, the majority of kids diagnosed these days in our country are done, this is done so on the basis of a 10 or 12 minute visit in a pediatrician's office without this thorough information. Now, on the one hand, you'd say, well, that's going to lead to overdiagnosis because all these other conditions might be mistaken for ADHD. But too often, the clinician might also say, well, he didn't seem to be tearing up the waiting room, or her parents tell me that she can play video games for hours on end. It can't be ADHD. You've got to get information about how the child or adolescent's performing during homework, on the soccer field, in everyday events, not just the behavior in that one-on-one office visit. So unless you take the time to get information out there in the real world, you might underdiagnose as well.
Let me ask you, there's this big debate in our greater society on how much this exists. Now, the medical evidence seems to state that, in fact, yes, when you do brain scans, you can see differences in brain scans, you can see differences in brain function in people who are truly diagnosed with ADHD, and you are seeing these differences. But is the debate still in the medical profession as well? So you might have a pediatrician who says, you know, there may be some cases, but I think it's pretty rare, and they believe in this overdiagnosis, and so they're less likely to do it.
Yeah, there's a lot of different standards in terms of medical or psychological training. Some people are really experts in this condition, some people less so. And you mentioned these biological differences we're finding in brain scans and research, and I think it's an important point. You can say the same for schizophrenia, for depression or bipolar disorder or autism, very serious disorders we talk about these days. At the level of research, on average, people with a certain mental illness, say bipolar disorder, ADHD in our case, we can find on average key brain differences in how many neurotransmitter receptors you have or even the size of certain brain regions. But that doesn't mean, at the state of the art we are now, that you can do a brain scan and definitively say, well, your brain shows you have this diagnosis and my brain shows I have that. There's too many individual differences. The brain is vastly complex. At a group level, we can say there's an average difference, but it's not enough now to make an individual brain-based diagnosis. Maybe in 50 years we'll be closer. And remember, with ADHD in particular, we're talking about behaviors. How attentive are you in school? How impulsive are you with your friends? There's always some subjectivity because we're talking about behavior, not just about blood pressure or something you could measure with an instrument. So for all of these reasons, we've got to take the time needed to get the information to make the best diagnostic guess we can.
Well, while there are some who are underdiagnosed, I think the fear, and really I think one of the themes of your book is it is very much overdiagnosed. In fact, I was surprised to read 2 years ago the demand for the drugs that treat ADHD actually overwhelmed supply, where people couldn't get the medications. Is that true?
That's true, and this ebbs and flows as well. There was a couple of years ago an undersupply. People who with legitimate diagnoses of ADHD would go to the pharmacy and there were literally no medicines on the shelf. So the Obama administration upped the quota levels. The supply is now back closer to where it should be. But one of the concerns is that if we let the supply go too high, these medications, the stimulants that are the main treatment for ADHD, can be abusable drugs if they're in the wrong hands. So we want to have the balance between having enough of the medication for legitimate medical and psychiatric need, but not having too much that might lead to what we call diversion. So diversion is the technical term for when an individual without a legitimate diagnosis is using a medication for other reasons. And the big issue for ADHD meds these days is that lots of college students, even high school students, as we're finding out with surveys, are taking stimulants because they've got that term paper due Friday and things are getting late, or that midterm's coming up, or even studying for the SATs or GREs.
And in fact, that trend way predates ADHD, too. Stronger stimulants.
That's right. And so the question is, it works for fluoride in the water supply. Maybe we'd have a more productive society if we just put stimulants and low doses in the water supply. And, of course, I'm saying that tongue-in-cheek.
Please, yes.
Right. So here's the real issue. These pills are being touted as performance enhancers or smart pills by some people. Now, it's clear that if you take these medicines, you will stay up later. You will have a chance at pulling the all-nighter to get that cramming done. But the real question is, are the medicines actually helping your learning? And very recent research has shown that, whereas, again, these medicines can help you stay more alert for a longer period of time, the effects on people without ADHD, the so-called normal population, in terms of actually enhancing your memory or your verbal learning are very small. And if you have ADHD and you're getting careful medical monitoring, the odds that you'll become addicted to these medicines are vanishingly small. But for the college student, this prototypic college student without ADHD who says, gee, that felt pretty good to do that all-nighter and I got a little buzz off these pills, the chances of becoming addicted are 10 to 15%, and stimulant addiction is not a pretty sight. So I believe that we're playing with fire to think that these medicines should just be available to anyone who needs them to make a more productive society.
One of the things your book, The ADHD Explosion, does is look at the trajectory of ADHD as a concept and a diagnosis. I was surprised to learn that people were writing about this, what, in the late 1800s?
That's exactly right, even the late 1700s. Mm. And what's interesting to me and scholars who study this is that when did this first start being the subject of medical attention? Very coincidentally, or not so coincidentally, timed with when societies began to invoke compulsory education. So, we have been a human species for at least 100,000 years. We know that certain genes exist that help our brains produce certain neurotransmitters, and some of us are very highly focused, and others of us are more impulsive and sensation-seeking and flit from idea to idea, and it was probably a good idea back in early evolutionary times for there to be some diversity, some people much more cautious and attentive and other people more impulsive. In fact, it may be that some of the sensation seekers and more impulsive types were those who moved in the face of climate change, and it was a good idea for some of the population to be restless. Then, fast forward to the last couple of seconds of evolutionary time, when societies say all kids need to learn to read, and the post-industrial revolution's taken place. Now, those individuals, as kids, who formerly were sometimes maybe viewed as the explorers, are now those who have a really hard time sitting still, focusing, learning to read. So that one of the points we make in the book is that there's a biology behind ADHD. In fact, whether you're very attentive or very inattentive is determined largely by the genes you carry. But this became very salient and noticeable to society once we decided that everybody's got to be a learner, everybody's got to be in school a certain number of hours a day. So there's a biological and a cultural aspect of this condition. And once now that we've got much more achievement pressure, probably rates of ADHD diagnosis are going up even higher.
I was also thinking of cultural changes. You know, say in the first half of the 20th century, kids were expected to do an awful lot of work before school, after school, just as a part of the household. You know, Before we had a lot of household conveniences. Kids might, if you're in a rural area, you worked well after school on a farm or before school for several hours, and that may have provided that sort of physical outlet. And now nowadays, and it seems like the explosion of diagnosis sort of goes at the time when we say we don't have time for physical activity during the school day. We have to be learning the whole time. I'm wondering if there's any sort of correlation there.
Well, animal models with non-human species suggest that physical activity is obviously very important for neural development and all kinds of development, and that animals deprived of physical activity show some of the animal equivalents of ADHD. I'm not convinced that lack of recess time or this, as you mentioned, trend toward all school and no outdoor play is the cause of ADHD, but like many other things, the increased expectations for learning at ever earlier ages, not enough time for physical activity, the incredible pressure, just I saw in the paper yesterday, how the admissions rates to the elite colleges in the United States were at their all-time lows last year, getting ever more difficult every year. All of these cultural changes are fueling whether there's an actual increase in inattentiveness. Certainly, the temptation to diagnose more and more kids. We know that ADHD is one of these diagnoses that, if the label is given, it might get you extra time on tests. It might get you treatments that can help your learning, so there's incentive to diagnose, even in, especially with these poor and cursory diagnostic practices we talked about. when that quick and dirty diagnosis is sometimes too easy to give.
My guest today is Stephen Hinshaw, professor of psychology at the University of California. He's editor of the Psychological Bulletin and co-author of The ADHD Explosion: Myths, Medication, Money, and Today's Push for Performance. It's published by Oxford University Press and is our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Are there conditions that certainly mask ADHD or perhaps are thought of as ADHD and it's a separate condition altogether? Give us a sense of how we make the we talked about the cursory diagnosis, but you mentioned the history of the patient, but what are the other things that we can do to sort of definitively make this diagnosis?
So with all of the brain scans now available, objective tests of attention, all this is helpful from a research perspective, but the clinician has to realize these days ADHD is still a pretty low-tech diagnosis. If I'm a 3-year-old boy, because my brain is maturing somewhat slowly and slower than that of a girl, I'm going to have a lot of inattention and impulse control problem. Could you ever diagnose ADHD in that 3- or 4-year-old boy? Yes, but only if that boy is way extreme compared to other kids his age. So one of the first things the clinician needs to do is to get instruments completed by the preschool teacher, in this case, by the parent, that have norms built in, so that the level of behavioral problems we're talking about aren't just typical for other kids that age, but are vastly atypical for kids that age. We talked about getting a thorough history in order to rule in the symptoms and to rule out child trauma or abuse, medical problems like seizures, depression. One of the cardinal symptoms of depression is poor concentration. Lots of other things in the normal and atypical part of the spectrum can look like ADHD. You've got to get very careful quantitative scales to know how extreme the behavior is. You want to get a sense of a history. Is it just this one year with this one teacher where things aren't going well, or has there been this kind of set of problems for a long time to get a definitive sense that you've ruled out most of the other competing diagnoses? ADHD seems like the most viable candidate.
Let me bring in the school element. How important is the school element in this sort of rising rates of ADHD? Because I know an awful lot of people where this has been diagnosed, a lot of times that first inkling comes from the school itself. Not
absolutely. A parent may say, well, no, he didn't seem terribly focused at home, but he was our firstborn. We didn't really get the picture until the second and third and fourth grade teacher said, the other kids can't learn, and he's really unfocused and inattentive. So school is often the place where these symptoms get identified and where school personnel are justifiably concerned. And we know that, again, this is a diagnosis that can get you some special services. What's really interesting that we talk about in the book is that not only are the rates of ADHD diagnosis going up around the country, but there's major variation regionally. The South and some parts of the Midwest have 2 to 3 times higher rates of these diagnoses than way out here in the far west, Nevada, California. Is it the water supply? Is it who lives in these states? We systematically tried to rule in or rule out explanatory factors. Is it the number of doctors per county? None of that made a difference until we started to look at school policies. To make a long story short, if you're in a state where test scores are really prioritized, that's the acid test for whether your district continues to get funded or not, and we looked at changes in those state accountability laws over time, shortly after those accountability laws come into play, rates of ADHD diagnosis tend to surge, especially for the poorest kids in those states. So we found what we think is close to a smoking gun, that in these very high rates we're finding in some parts of the country, educational pressure and insisting on test scores as the essentially only measure of how well a kid is doing may have an unintended consequence of pushing rates of diagnosis ever higher.
And in fact, I'm looking at a chart of the United States, and you look at the top rates, which I guess tops out at about 15% compared to the U.S. average of about 9.4%. It's Arkansas,
right.
Tennessee, North Carolina, Alabama, Indiana, Ohio. Oklahoma is above average. We're somewhere in the 10 to 12% range. You look at the far west, California, Nevada, well below, and the northeast in Illinois. It's very interesting. How big does this sort of political accountability play in it, do you think?
Well, we thought first maybe it's who lives in a state. Now, we know in California there's a much bigger Hispanic population than in, say, North Carolina. These are our two sort of poster states, North Carolina with very high rates and California with relatively low rates. But even if you factor into the equation, well, there's many more Hispanics in California than in North Carolina, taking that into account doesn't really eliminate much of this difference. It's when we started to look at school policies and these accountability laws that make the testing really count. Once we factored that in, a big explanation took place as to these divergent state rates of diagnosis. So ADHD has a biological reality, but when test scores count to the exclusion of other factors, there's a big incentive to diagnose.
What was more interesting to me was the disparity in medication rates, because with this diagnosis, now think about it, you could be in a state where that medication rate is as low as one-third of all diagnoses receive medication to the upper limit, it looks like about almost 80%.
In fact, with the more recent data, with the more recent maps, some states are between 80 and 85% of diagnosed kids getting medicated now. So that's big variation. And we find that rates of medication are also subject to these educational policies, just the way rates of diagnosis are. So it's complicated. It's what the clinician has been trained in, whether the clinician believes that maybe we should try behavioral, family, and school interventions before medication. Are there people the doctor works with that can do those kinds of treatments? Medication can be enormously beneficial for people with ADHD. Don't get me wrong, and I've done studies and have reviewed the world literature on this topic. But we know one thing for sure. Medication can really help reduce some of the fidgety and squirmy and inattentive symptoms. But if you want to teach academic or social skills or help a family to become more consistent in their disciplinary style, you've got to supplement medication with very intensive behavioral management, school consultative procedures. The combination treatments are going to teach skills far more than medication alone.
My guest today is Stephen Henshaw, professor of psychology at the University of California, editor of the Psychological Bulletin, and co-author of The ADHD Explosion, Myth, Medication, Money, and Today's Push for Performance. Are there good sort of intercessionary techniques to family interventions that work as well as medication or instead of medication? When you get this diagnosis, are there ways of changing behaviors, learning adaptive techniques for the child that can work instead of medication, or is it usually in tandem with medication that perhaps?
Yes, I mean, some families are opposed to medication. Some small subset of kids have bad side effects, can't take medication. So in some cases, we need alternative treatments. Most of the research will point to the fact that medication works often quite well, but it's the conjunctive or additive benefits of these other treatments that make the bigger difference. So you think of a child going into a therapist's office and sitting and talking and maybe playing with toys, and the therapist analyzes the behavior patterns. Those kinds of individual therapy or play therapy strategies aren't very effective for kids with ADHD. What's been shown time and time again to be effective is working a lot with the family, a much more regular reward program, a timeout chair or corner rather than yelling and screaming, having the teacher break assignments into smaller steps and systematically rewarding those, even sometimes working with groups of kids to help their social skills. Mm. These behavior mod style interventions don't work as fast as medications, but over the long run may be as effective. And again, to really teach skills, the combining of medication with these interventions makes the biggest difference.
And I think there are a lot of parents that when they're getting into this, they really fear the fact that nearly all of these medications, and there may be a few new drugs in the last couple of years, are really powerful stimulants. I mean,
yeah,
very powerful. I mean, they're basically amphetamines, what we called amphetamines anyway, at
right.
one point. So I think that's really important.
Well, it is important, and again, under proper medical supervision at the right dosage, these medicines are not addictive for people with ADHD, and they can be helpful. But again, these are powerful medications that we don't want lying around cabinets or lying around dorm rooms.
Now, let's talk about that last part of your subtitle, Today's Push for Performance. How big a part of this do you think this is, not only in test scores, but in job performance? And, I mean, because you look at the statistics, there's, you know, if you have a diagnosis of ADHD, you're more likely to be unemployed, you're more likely to have state services or social services, you're more likely to make less money if you are employed, maybe in the same job, you know?
That's exactly right, and I'm glad you raised this. The biggest market today for diagnosis and treatment is not kids with ADHD. We've kind of almost saturated that market. It's for adults. We thought 30 years ago when I was in grad school that ADHD kind of disappeared when you hit puberty, when you hit your teen years. Yes, the most fidgety, squirmy behaviors go underground, but the problems in attention and impulse control, many cases, at least half the time, persist into adulthood. And as you point out, and as we note in the book, the cost to the U.S. economy last year related to ADHD in adults, mainly because of these job-related problems, was toward $200 billion. So this is a costly condition. There's high rates of accidental injury for not only kids but adults with ADHD. So it's not just intolerance of different learning styles. This is a condition with real consequences. And if we could get individuals in treatment, the right medication dose, cognitive behavioral therapies for adults where people are monitoring their behaviors, rewarding themselves, finding the right cues so that they can pay better attention and stay on the job better, maybe deciding not to send that nasty email to your new boss first thing because you're upset. These are the things that make a big difference in terms of ultimate productivity.
And we know from the latest brain research that, you know, the impulse control is the frontal cortex, and this is the last developing part, and it really only develops in early adulthood. Do we get a sense that ADHD is still inhibiting that impulse control, even in fully developed adults otherwise?
There's really interesting research by Philip Shaw, who works back at the National Institutes of Health, and his colleagues. To make a long story short, they have been tracking a large sample of kids, some of whom have ADHD. It's not an ADHD study per se. It's a sort of developmental brain imaging study. The subgroup of kids with ADHD, not just in childhood but in adolescence and even beyond, are several years behind their typically developing peers in the maturation of their prefrontal cortex. So it's that thin layer of the brain on the outside where all the action is. So ADHD may truly be a developmental immaturity. It's not just in childhood, it's through adolescence that these immaturities are still showing up. We don't know if this is directly related to genes. We don't know if there's early experiences that might foster better brain development, but at the level of the brain itself, there may be an immaturity here. That's exactly right.
Mm. Well, it's a really interesting book, The ADHD Explosion, going into all the issues that surround this. Still, it's a controversial diagnosis, although it is a very much a real disorder, and it's very fully descriptive of the whole process. Stephen Henshaw, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for your great questions, and it was a delight to be on.
Psychologist Stephen Henshaw speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. He's a professor of psychology at the University of California and the vice chair for psychology at the Department of Psychiatry at the University of California, San Francisco. He's the editor of Psychological Bulletin. He and health economist Richard Scheffler are the co-authors of The ADHD Explosion, Myths, Medication, Money, and Today's Push for Performance. It's published by Oxford University Press. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.